Hello and welcome. We're going to get the program started now. Thank you so much to everybody. I'm Kathy Murphy, president of the Greater Des Moines Public Arts Foundation. Thank you for joining me and the board as we celebrate the groundbreaking for an extraordinary public arts project. I'd like to recognize our local officials and special guests who will be participating in today's ceremony. City Council Member Christine Hensley, Judge Odell McGee, who's past president of the Iowa National Bar Association, Judge Ramonda Belcher, William Morris, grandson of MBA founder James B. Morris Sr., Danielle Carr, regional director of the National Bar Association, Broderick Johnson, assistant to the president and cabinet secretary for Barack Obama, and chair of my Brother's Keepers Task Force. The Public Arts Foundation is a private, nonprofit organization. Its mission is to engage, inspire, and enrich the lives of citizens and visitors to our community, and to increase cultural awareness by establishing a world-class destination for public art. Today is an exciting milestone for both the Public Arts Foundation and for our community. Today, we begin preserving the legacy of 12 extraordinary individuals who were dedicated to fighting segregation and legal racism. These pioneering attorneys founded the National Bar Association here in Des Moines, Iowa in 1925. Because they were denied membership in the American Bar Association solely based on the color of their skin, today, we celebrate the example and accomplishment they set with a world-class public arts project called A Monumental Journey, created by internationally acclaimed artist Kerry James Marshall. Kerry regrets that he cannot join us today, but he'll be back in Des Moines when we dedicate the monument next spring. A retrospective of his work just opened in New York City last week at the Metropolitan Museum of Art after a record show at the Chicago Museum of Contemporary Art, where they called him one of America's greatest living artists. We could have found no better person to honor the founders of the NBA. We are also grateful for the hundreds of supporters and donors to this project. More than a year ago, the Public Arts Foundation launched a campaign to raise the remaining $1 million needed to fund this inspiring public arts project. I am pleased to announce that we are almost there and proud to recognize the project's major donors: the City of Des Moines via the Greater Des Moines Public Arts Foundation, Prairie Meadows, Mid-American Energy Company, Bravo Greater Des Moines, the William C. Knapp Charitable Foundation, Sharon and Kyle Kraus, Musco Lighting, and Substance Architecture. The idea for this public arts project began with a dialogue between the Iowa Bar Association's past president, Odell McGee, and the National Bar Association's past president, Yvette Simmons. It is my great pleasure to introduce Judge Odell McGee.
Thank you, Kathy. And thank all of you for coming to this groundbreaking of A Monumental Journey. To our guests, NBA Regional Director Carr, Mr. Johnson, Ms. Murphy, to all you great supporters, friends, and also to dreamers like myself. Back in the year 2000, Yvette Simmons and I put together a celebration for the 75th anniversary of the founding of the NBA. And Yvette and several of the national offices came to Des Moines. And we drove around town trying to find historical, something historical that would say that the National Bar Association was founded in this city. And the only thing we could find was we knew that they met at the St. Paul AME Church up on 9th and University. But there was not very much else other than, I guess, someone had handmade a small memorial that was in the parking lot of that church to represent these brave people who had founded this organization. And Yvette and I sat in the parking lot, and she said, you know, it would be really nice if we had something, something's coming out of the ground somewhere that would be a reminder to people that some folks passed this way. And I said, you know what, let's do it. Let's make something happen. And she said, well, go ahead, get it done. But I came up with the idea and drew all these different types of designs and tuck them to people. You would just be interested to see the design changes the statute has gone through in the last 16 years. We have at least 20 different designs, and I was going through some materials the other day and saw all the differing designs that it has gone through, and to come up with the one that we presently have is just simply amazing. These 12 people, actually, I'm going to be a little prejudicial and say actually the five people, because the first five founders of the organization were all Iowans. They founded the Negro Bar Association in 1924, before the start of the National Bar Association. And those five founders that we are so proud of and we all know so well includes Gertrude Rush, George Woodson, S. Joe Brown, J.B. Morris, and Charles P. Howard. This group of individuals refused to allow membership denial to destroy their need for legal development, group association, and community improvement. They decided, since they were denied admission to the ABA, or the American Bar Association, that they just start their own. And that spirit is what has lifted me, because from my perspective, when you're denied something, start your own. I mean, that's the type of spirit that is so important and so prevalent. Well, I went to see a friend of mine, my business advisor. I only had $5, but he was a business advisor at the time, a guy by the name of Ralph Gross. I don't know if you're Ralph, but he was working with the Merrill Lynch people at the time. And Ralph said, Odell, I sat and talked to him one evening. We had a couple glasses of wine, and of course he just, well, you're so excited about it. He said, we got to do something about it. He said, let's go do it. He said, I can help you get the money. And Ralph Gross started talking to people around town about what we wanted to do. We went to talk to the Des Moines Public Art Foundation, and they helped us. And ultimately, commissioned Kerry James Marshall to develop a project. His concept of an American talking drum. When you see this project, this is a talking drum. If you don't know, in Africa, many of the ways that the folk communicated from village to village was by way of a talking drum. And so this project is a talking drum. And Kerry James decided, well, let's think about this. He took the talking drum, he cut it half in two, right down the middle, and then balanced it atop each other. The whole concept being that even though words and thoughts are different, if they are balanced, they can still create justice. And of course, we know justice is never straight up and down. So that's what you're going to be looking at, this concept of justice. It's going to be teetering, but it's going to never fall, because that's the way justice is. If justice is balanced, it will forever stand. This is the type of vision of fairness and justice that our founders hoped for. The search for fairness and justice initially caused the need to formulate the National Bar Association. The Iowa National Bar Association is eternally thankful for all of you who have supported us, who have prayed with us, who's fought with me, and who's told me you can't do it that way. And I say, yes, I am. And you don't know you can't. I just want to say thank you to all of you who have made a monumental journey a reality. Now, please join me in welcoming National Bar Association Midwest Regional Director, Danielle Carr. Ms. Carr is a resident of St. Louis. She attended the University of Northern Iowa and received her law degree from the University of Michigan Law School. She is presently employed by the law firm of Passanelli, PC, which is one of the largest and most reputable law firms in the country. Active in community and bar association work, Danielle has received many local and national awards for excellence in legal, community, and business performance. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome for Danielle Carr. Thank you all so much.
Good evening, everyone. It is an honor and pleasure to be here today on behalf of the National Bar Association for the groundbreaking ceremony for a monumental journey. From the first 12 lawyers who formed the organization, the NBA is now recognized as the oldest and largest association of predominantly African-American lawyers, judges, educators, and law students. From representation of the association in less than five cities, the organization is now boasts 84 affiliate chapters throughout the United States, as well as in Canada, the United Kingdom, Africa, Morocco, and the Caribbean. Much praise to the founders and their vision, which blossomed into an organization that now boasts more than 60,000 members. One of the MBA founders, James Brad Morris Jr., launched his legal career right here in Des Moines, Iowa, after being invited by George Woodson, who was also an NBA founder and the organization's first president, to join him in his law practice. Morris also made his mark in the community and the lives of African-American Iowans as the publisher of The Bystander, which was a weekly record of national, state, and local news, African-American achievement, and protest. When Morris published his farewell editorial in June 1971, he reflected, "Certainly, a business that has operated for 77 years has merit, has earned a place in the hearts of people, and produced some satisfaction to those who have, in any way, had a part in its niche in the community." If Morris were alive today, he could say almost the exact same thing about the National Bar Association, an organization that continues to thrive more than 90 years later and beneficially impacts the individuals and communities it serves. On this momentous occasion, brought about by much dedication, 11 years I hear, and financial support for which the NBA gives much thanks and appreciation, the breaking of this ground marks the beginning of an artistic testament to those who paved the way for an organization that still holds true to its original purpose and is now recognized as the collective voice for African-American attorneys and the one of the premier advocates for issues that most impact African-American lives. For me, the monument will serve as a reminder of how proud I am to be an African-American attorney who provides support to advancing the National Bar Association's initiatives, and how proud I am to call the state that gave birth to the NBA my home. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today, Danielle, and thank you for your support throughout this project and for support from the NBA. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce a special guest representing the White House. Broderick Johnson is the Assistant to the President and Cabinet Secretary to President Barack Obama and Chair of the My Brother's Keeper's Task Force. Mr. Johnson has held positions in both the public and private sectors. He was a senior advisor to the Obama presidential campaign in 2012, an informal advisor to the Obama presidential campaign in 2008, and was the senior congressional affairs advisor to the Kerry campaign in 2004. During the Clinton administration, he served as Deputy Assistant to the President for Legislative Affairs. Mr. Johnson was previously a vice president at AT&T and Bell South Corporations. He was a partner at Bryan Cave, an international law firm, where he headed the Public Policy and Government Affairs Group and served on the firm's executive committee. Mr. Johnson also co-founded the Collins Johnson Group, specializing in providing strategic policy and communications advice to corporations and nonprofits. He has served as a board director of philanthropic and academic groups, including Concerned Black Men, Project North Star, the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and the Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Mr. Johnson received his BA from the College of the Holy Cross and his JD from the University of Michigan, where he has lectured on public policy and government relations. Mr. Johnson.
Good evening. I guess I don't have to say go blue, do I, Daniel? Oh, that's right, I'm in Iowa. Sorry. Big Ten and Michigan plays Iowa later this season, and we're having a great season. Please don't mess it up. Let me begin, though, on a very serious note. On behalf of the President, First Lady, and all of my colleagues at the White House, we join all of you in mourning the tragic deaths of Sergeant Anthony Bimineo and Officer Justin Martin, who were so senselessly killed in the line of duty earlier this week. We pray for their loved ones and for this entire community. It's a beautiful evening here in Des Moines. I haven't been to Des Moines before. I've avoided coming to Des Moines because of a political season. Oftentimes, when it brings you to Des Moines, it brings you to ice and snow. But this is fantastic. Thank you very much for inviting me here now. I'm not involved in the campaign. There's something called the Hatch Act that I have to pay very close attention to. I don't want to violate that. So please don't ask me how I feel about the presidential campaign. It wouldn't take much for you all to imagine who I hope wins next week. So let's just leave it at that. Again, it's indeed an honor, though, for me to be here tonight and to bring greetings and best wishes on behalf of our 44th President of the United States, President Barack Obama. Just 5 days from now, we will know who will succeed the president. And just 11 weeks from now, we will all be turning over our keys and packing up our boxes and leaving the White House. The reality of that hit me yesterday. I left my office for a little while to run an errand. My office is in the West Wing of the White House. It's a wonderful place to work. It's a lot smaller, though, than you imagine or the TV shows would depict. And I noticed this fenced-off area and these cranes, and I realized that the crews have now come in to start building the parade stand for the inauguration of the next president of the United States. And that's when it kind of hit me, and that's when I was like, yeah, it is time to go, isn't it? So, and I get to watch that be created, but I don't think I'll be sitting in that box in January. I'll be somewhere on a beach somewhere, hopefully resting and getting some nice sun. While he's unable to be here today, I want to also thank Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack for helping you all to extend this invitation for me to be here this evening. As you all know, Tom Vilsack is a very proud Iowan. He is also the only current member of the President's Cabinet who has served since the President took office in January of 2009. It says an awful lot about Tom Vilsack's dedication. And I'm very proud to call both Tom and his wife, Christy, my very good personal friends. This beautiful fall evening, we come together not only to honor the past, but also to acknowledge the enduring impact of a group of courageous, trailblazing attorneys from nearly a century ago. We gather here to honor 12 African-American attorneys who were bold and visionary and deeply committed to the pursuit of simple justice. The monument we dedicate in their honor symbolizes that our legal system, while indeed not perfect, remains a work in progress, always in the process of striking a just and fair balance. The historical backdrop for this story is familiar to all of us. A group of African Americans, just as capable and passionate and credentialed as their white counterparts, were denied entry into the mainstream organizations of their profession. America of 1925 looked, of course, a lot different than America of November 2016. We need look no further than the Oval Office to see that. There were nearly 10 million African Americans in this country then, representing just under 10% of this nation's population. At that time, there were actually fewer than 1,000 African American attorneys in this nation. The dearth of African-American presence in the courts was even more stark in the halls of Congress, where there was not even one African-American member of Congress sitting in the 69th Congress. While the American Bar Association admitted its first black lawyer, William Henry Lewis, in 1911, hundreds of African-American lawyers were systematically denied admission to the American Bar Association through 1925. Lawyers like Gertrude Durden Rush, George H. Woodson, S. Joe Brown, James B. Morris, and Charles P. Howard Sr. all had the credentials and the intellect, but were nonetheless denied ABA membership cards. So on August 1st, 1925, right here in Des Moines, in this beautiful city in the middle of America's heartland, those five individuals joined Wendell E. Green, Cornelius Francis Stafford, Jesse Nathaniel Baker, William H. Haynes, George Cornelius Adams, Charles H. Calloway, and L. Amasa Knox to found what would become the National Bar Association. For that, all of us, especially African-American lawyers, can be eternally grateful. The legacy of these individuals within the NBA is great, no doubt, but it is also about so much more than the establishment of an association or an organization. Their courage and their dignity and their example have inspired so many great men and women of color to become lawyers throughout the decades. It was in 1925 that Thurgood Marshall was graduating from Frederick Douglass High School in my hometown, Baltimore, Maryland. And while biographers have noted that a young Thurgood Marshall intended to study medicine and become a dentist, it was in 1925 that he wrote in his college application to Lincoln University that his goal was, in fact, to become an attorney. Now, surely that timing was not mere coincidence, but due perhaps in large measure to the impact of that determined dozen here in Des Moines. While it took one generation for African-American lawyers then to go from being excluded from the ABA to having the first African-American justice on the Supreme Court, we all know, don't we, that that struggle for opportunity and equality continues today. If you all will indulge me, I'd like to share some things about my own journey toward becoming a lawyer. I too was born in Baltimore, Maryland in 1956, just 2 years after Brown versus Board of Education was decided. I was born to parents who were striving to attain middle-class status in a very segregated city. Like Justice Marshall, my parents attended Frederick Douglass High School. They saw endless potential in their own futures, but there were so many barriers to the futures that they dreamed about. They saw it in me, though, and so they made sure that I had the opportunities, the education, to be able to live my dreams out. But it was in the second grade, just the second grade, when a teacher told my parents that their seven-year-old son was probably well on his way to reform school. That was sort of the early description of the school-to-prison pipeline. My mom and dad, of course, did what good parents do. They removed me from that school, and they put me in a Catholic school where the nuns could help straighten me out. And in that school, I learned to believe, of course, that all things were possible, but the doubts didn't end there. Decades later, when I decided, as I was graduating from college, that I wanted to become a lawyer, my very well-intentioned philosophy advisor said, well, you shouldn't apply to Michigan Law School, because that's a really hard law school to get into. And if you get in there, you might be a C student. So the rest is history. God bless him for giving me the motivation to say I will do better than you ever imagined. Had my parents, though, tolerated the idea when I was a young boy that they should lower their expectations, imagine for me what my life would be. So I am so grateful to them, and I know that they are eternally proud of what I've been able to accomplish. It is that sense of optimism, that sense of turning the improbable into the probable, and the belief that all of our children have the right to a bright future, that they can dream it and live it, that drives my work at the White House on behalf of the President, where again I have the honor of serving not only as the President's Cabinet Secretary, but also as the chair of his My Brother's Keeper Task Force. President Obama launched that task force 2.5 years ago. from the same room in the White House where the 1964 Civil Rights Act of was signed into law. That is no small coincidence. It was an indication of how much it mattered to the president as president for the nation to see what his priorities were. That program is designed to make sure that boys and young men of color can, like all other children, have opportunities to fulfill their real potential. In response to the president's call to action, there are now nearly 250 My Brother's Keeper communities in every state of the United States, including here in Des Moines, Iowa, DC, Puerto Rico, and Indian nations across this country. The My Brother's Community Challenge has brought about $1 billion in new private sector and philanthropic grants, and another $1 billion in low-interest financing to help advance the goals of MBK. And at the federal level, we have adopted new policy initiatives across the agencies, new grant programs, all being implemented to do a number of very important things. First, to help end preschool suspensions. There were 4,000 children suspended or expelled from preschool in the United States in 2012. These are kids that are about this tall. 80% of those kids are children of color, and 80% of those children of color are boys. Also, to prepare all children to read by the third grade. We know how critical it is for third graders to be able to read on schedule. To tackle chronic absenteeism, to break the school-to-prison pipeline, to prepare our kids for the global economy. MBK is not just a moral issue, it's also an economic issue. We need to leave no young people in this country on the playing field as we try to compete with other countries across the globe. And to give folks a second chance, because everyone makes mistakes in life and everyone deserves a second chance. Let me extend appreciation to the NBA, by the way, for partnering with us in our MBK work by pledging 4,000 pro bono hours to help expunge the records of those otherwise kept from returning to public housing and ultimately reuniting with their families. So thank you, NBA, very much for that. Yes, that applause is very well recognized. I know for certain, because the president has mentioned this so many times to me personally, and he has mentioned it publicly, that the work of My Brother's Keeper will remain important to him for the rest of his life. So if people wonder, well, is it going to go away when the president leaves office? In fact, the president's very clear. This is work that is life mission to him. Let me just say a few more things about this president's commitment to greater fairness in our criminal justice system. From the signing of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010, which reduced the disparity in punishment between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, to the Attorney General's own Smart on Crime initiative, which changed the Justice Department's charging policies to avoid triggering excessive mandatory minimums, to the creation of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, which has brought together community leaders, law enforcement representatives, academics, and youth activities to come up with concrete and specific blueprints for how to build trust between police and communities. With all those things, this president has reformed many broken elements of our criminal justice system. The president is not done. He's established a clemency initiative to encourage individuals who are sentenced under outdated laws to petition for commutation, and the president has used that power to commute the sentences of 872 individuals, more than the last 11 presidents combined. This year alone, the president has granted 688 clemency petitions. And again, he is not done. I want to close with this. When the president spoke at Howard University's commencement this past spring, he had this to say about Justice Marshall and Justice Marshall's mentor, Charles Hamilton Houston. The president said, quote, "They knew it would not be easy. They knew it would not be quick. They knew all sorts of obstacles would stand in their way. They knew that even if they won, they would just be the beginning of a longer march to equality. But they had discipline, they had persistence, they had faith, and they had a sense of humor. And they made life better for all Americans." Well, that's what we see here today, persistence. Thank you for your persistence. I assume you also have a great sense of humor as you've had to work and raise money for this. So, again, the same things can be said about the dedicated Des Moines Dozen, and all the lawyers who have followed in the years since then. I am so proud to be part of this dedication here today, this tremendous honor being bestowed upon those who showed such great courage all those years ago, and I am deeply personally grateful to be here with all of you today. Thank you. God bless all of you, and God bless this already great nation. Thank you.